Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 44. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing the Patreon thing again, and I'm doing a movie suggested by Elaine, one of our Patreon subscribers, and that is Dark City from 1998. And then I'm looking at a favourite of mine from the 1980s, a smaller film which kind of got swallowed by a bunch of larger genre films at the time. And that is 1985's My Science Project, starring John Stockwell and Dennis Hopper. So sit back, relax, I'll get the contact details and the credits out of the way, and we'll get on with the show.
The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show.
And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his. Okay, so how's everybody going? Spring is here. It's all going nice. Printemps is sprung. And we're just planning this little trip to Sydney so I can give away my sister at her wedding next weekend. And I'm looking forward to that enormously, particularly given the fact that it's a very, very casual wedding. I think it may even be on a beach because they've told me I can wear sandals, which is kind of cool. And looking forward to that. Going to be away for about a week and catching up with family and just doing the groovy thing and visiting my hometown. So really great fun, that. And a road trip of 800 kilometres is always fun for Sal and I, because what we tend to do is this. We'll do a playlist on the iPods, and while the other person is driving, they get the radio, you know, hooked into the iPod. And the person who isn't driving has their headphones on and listens to their own music. Because Sal and I have incredibly different tastes in music. Mine's terrific, hers isn't, though she would say it's the other way around. But one way or the other, I'm setting up my playlist. I'm going to have a lot of film music on there. I'm going to have some cool jazz. I'm going to have some new stuff that I haven't heard before. And about 5 o'clock one morning, we're going to drive all the way up there, reach Sydney about mid-afternoon maybe, and hang out with family. So it's all going to be fun. Which brings me to the next thing, which is what I've been watching. Now, there hasn't been a hell of a lot because there hasn't been a lot of time since I last podcasted, but I've watched a few genre films, so talk about them. I did see a weird little effort called Space Station 76, directed by Jack Plotnick, the actor, and starring Patrick Wilson, Liv Tyler, who's the only person called Liv who can't act, and a bunch of other people. And it's basically set on a space station, and it's a retro 1970s-style space station. There are a lot of dramas between the individual characters and things like that. A lot of really kind of retro 1970s future tech, And it's very low key, and it's a lot more style over substance, but it's not too bad. I kind of enjoyed it while it lasted. Fairly low budget effort, but it's got some groovy set designs and really funky stuff. It's almost like they're in the same universe as Space 1999 based on the set designs, but that's worth checking out if you get a chance to. And what isn't worth checking out if you get a chance to is Transformers The Age of Extinction, which I fell asleep during the action scenes of while I was watching it, which goes to show you that it's not very good. But Michael Bay and also Mark Wahlberg together, the match made in hell. Yeah, there are giant robots smashing things up. Dead people don't seem to matter too much. Not any fantastic acting, though Stanley Tucci does give it a good go. He's in there cashing a check, of course. But all credit to him, he's actually paid his dues. And, it's the kind of thing 12-year-old kids would like. But anybody with a more developed brain probably wouldn't. So I can't really recommend that. I just watched it because I managed to download a copy. And no, it was a waste of my time. I did also see a fairly good film, which I kind of enjoyed, though it's... Yeah, I'm not sure about the ending of it. I've still got to think about it because I only watched it today. And that is Terry Gilliam's The Zero Theorem, which has got a very textured universe. It's slightly futuristic, very textured, very weird. A little bit Brazil-y, which is not inconsistent with the fact that it was directed by Terry Gilliam. Stars Christoph Waltz and David Thewlis and a few other people. And, I did enjoy it, but I think I'm going to have to do a rewatch on that just to make sure I got everything. It's Gilliam's madness, of course, and the acting's very good. Waltz is very good. David Thewlis is very good. And the universe is kind of subtly dystopian in just the way the whole place is set up. So I watched that. And the only other thing I've watched of note, because I've been mainlining the TV series, a lot of my favourite TV series are coming back now, is the documentary about the life, career and death of Roger Ebert, Life Itself, it's called. And it's a good documentary. Of necessity, of course, it's a very downbeat one to the end, though very inspirational. If you're in this, doing this podcast, you're writing about movies or even talking about movies, Roger Ebert's influence is there, even if you don't know it is. He's a bit like the people who've just retired from At the Movies here in Australia. Our two most loved movie critics, David Stratton and Margaret Pomerantz, are no longer doing At the Movies, which they've been doing for 20-odd years together. And people like them and Roger Ebert, who open up and democratize movie criticism and movie reviewing and movie appreciation, are cultural treasures in a lot of ways, and this movie very much reflects that. It's a warts and all kind of documentary, and the documentary makers were given at times it seems almost like intrusive access into Roger Ebert's life as it was towards the end. But it's a good documentary, and being a big Ebert fan, I was looking forward to seeing it, and I wasn't disappointed at all. I do recommend it for any movie buff, and there's some good stuff there on a kind of healthy philosophy to take when examining movies and communicating about that in any medium to other people. I think that Ebert's attitude and Ebert's approach to this kind of stuff is very, very simpatico to my own. So that's about it. I haven't talked about the movies I'm going to talk about this time. Well, I did in the initial blurb, but I haven't really restated it, which I usually do. Elaine in Perth, who is one of our Patreon subscribers and a scientist as well, has chosen Dark City to be one of the movies for the podcast, and I'm very happy to honour that. I haven't revisited that one in a while, so I've got a few things to say about that. And then I'm going back to some VHS era nostalgia for myself by looking at Jonathan Boutel's My Science Project, starring John Stockwell, Fisher Stevens, and Dennis Hopper, which is something I watched on VHS back in the day. It's a fairly low-budget science fiction movie, but it's a little bit of fun, and I kind of did enjoy revisiting that one very much. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to do these in reverse order. I think I'll do Dark City first, and then I'll look at my science project.
Dr. Schreiber, I presume.
It's you. Hey, come on. It's no way to greet a patient, doctor. If that's what you are, huh? Doctor?
Mr. Murdoch, please, I...
What is happening here? Why is everyone asleep?
Shh, please, keep your voice down.
Why can't I remember anything? What have you done to me?
Nothing. Please, I want to help you. Here. It is not safe. If they see us together, they'll...
I don't care. I want some answers. I want some answers now. Who are they? Why are they trying to kill me? Answer me!
My God. You really can do it.
I did that.
Listen to me, John. You have their power. You can make things happen by will alone. They call it tuning. That is how they make the buildings change. Just now you acted out of self-defense, a reflex. But I can teach you to control your power consciously. Let me help you, John. Together we can stop them. We can take the city back.
That was Kiefer Sutherland and Rufus Sewell from the 1998 science fiction movie Dark City, directed by Alex Proyas. Here's the bit from Wikipedia about what it's about. Sewell plays John Murdoch, a man suffering from amnesia, who finds himself accused of murder. Murdoch attempts to discover his true identity to clear his name while on the run from the police and a mysterious group known only as the Strangers in a city that never experiences daytime. This one came from 1998. It was filmed in Australia, and there are tons of Australian character actors scattered through the minor players in the movie. The stars are all people from overseas, unfortunately. Would have been nice to get a few people in. The stars of the film are Rufus Sewell, Kiefer Sutherland, Jennifer Connelly, Richard O'Brien, Ian Richardson, and William Hurt. Wikipedia calls this one a neo-noir science fiction movie. Now, the only thing noir about it is the fact that it's set at nighttime, but some people don't know what film noir is really about. It was filmed about 10 kilometres from where my mum and my sister live, at Fox Studios in Sydney, which once upon a time, when the world was young, was the Sydney showgrounds, and I spent most of my childhood wandering around there once a year, getting show bags and watching agricultural exhibits and all sorts of things like that. But now it's a film studio, and I'm still, in my mind, it's still the showgrounds. But anyway, this one has a lot of influences, and I think that the best way I can describe this accurately, and I'm trying to be accurate with this, I'm not as in love with the film as a lot of other people are, is that it's style over substance, basically. I mean, there's a lot of there are a lot of movies. I mean, you can kind of go in there and just tick off movies that influence the visual style of Dark City. Things like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu, Metropolis. There's a big oofah component to the look of this one. But there are also other films, M as well. There's a little bit of Fritz Lang's M in there. La Jetée, I noticed a little bit of a tribute to La Jetée at times. And probably taking it out of there, it reminded me a little bit, and this is just personal, of Mr. Budwinger, an amnesiac movie set in New York starring James Garner. But here's the problem I have with the film, and I'll be right up front with it. I'm not going to hide it, and I'm sorry if this annoys anybody, particularly if it annoys Elaine, who asked me to do the film. My problem is this, and I'm going to do some spoilers because the movie's 15 years old. It's okay to do spoilers at this stage. 16 years old. I was inaccurate there. The whole setup is the fact that a whole bunch of aliens are using the corpses of human beings to kind of patrol and police and experiment on a bunch of human beings who were captured by them. They basically decide that what they want to do is do a mashup of the memories and minds of the people. So they take memories from one person and personalities from one person and change them around and experiment with them One night, when midnight strikes in the city, you can be a different person living a different life and not know it. And so everybody's memories are pretty much very shallow. Their personalities are shallow. They've basically been guinea pigged for an indefinite amount of time by these aliens. So here's where the problem comes in. Everybody has pretty much flattened effect. Nobody's vivid. Nobody's alive. Nobody's vital. Everything's a bit downbeat now. The music in this film also reflects that downbeat, kind of downtrodden thing. There are no eye-poppingly good characters. And the actors in the film have been chosen pretty much with that in mind. I mean, let's look at them. Rufus Sewell, who's go-to role. If Rufus Sewell was born to play one role, it would probably be the groundskeeper in Lady Chatterley's Lover. Not an incredibly gifted actor. Kiefer Sutherland's in there playing the scientist, as you heard in the clip, and he's trying to be Peter Lorre. Jennifer Connelly's in there, again, somebody whose skills are not of the highest level. Richard O'Brien's in there. Riff Raff from Rocky Horror, of course. He's New Zealander, so he's as close as they get to Australia for the main cast. And his character comes a little bit like a kind of Riff Raff on Mogadon, who is dressed funny. And he does try to put some menace into the character, but yeah, it doesn't quite work. Ian Richardson plays another one of the aliens, and William Hurt plays a copper called Bumstead, who's basically there for no true purpose except his death. His death reveals something about the movie, and that's the reason he's here. And all of them play it with this kind of dulled, flattened effect. And I don't know that that's what people come for when they're looking for a science fiction action film. And in a sense, this is. There is some great action stuff. There are some scenes particularly good where the city starts morphing and buildings rise up and change and mutate and all that kind of thing. And Rufus Sewell's character, Murdoch, is running across the rooftops. And yeah, that all that stuff works really well. And Lewis Morley's miniature work in this one is fantastic. But really, you've got to, with this kind of film, you've got to have a viewpoint character with whom the audience relates. You've got to have a tag there. You've got to have somebody that go, okay, that's my guy. And this film doesn't really present that. We don't know who Murdoch is. Murdoch doesn't know who Murdoch is. All we know is that he's a guy who can tune, which means that he can change things in the city the same way that the aliens can. That's his only personality trait that's discernible, apart from the fact that he thinks that Jennifer Connelly's character is hot. And I'm not using the names of the characters apart from Murdoch, because their names change as their characters change. Murdoch and Bumstead are the only non-mutable human characters in the movie. Now, the look of the film is very good. Dark Knight Streets. There's a couple of scenes that look like they were filmed underneath the Harbour Bridge, using the stanchions for the Harbour Bridge, which are quite good. So the look of the film's fine. And I like Proyas as a director for a number of reasons. He's an Egyptian-born Greek-Australian, and he has done some interesting films in the past. I'll just grab his stuff here because I actually printed out some things. Yes, I'm using old school paper stuff just because I can. And Proyas's films, of course, he started out with The Crow. He actually started in 89 with Spirits of Air, Gremlins of the Clouds, which I haven't seen, but I probably should. The Crow he did, and that was a big success. Not entirely unrelated to the fact that Brandon Lee died during the making of it. He did the 2004 iRobot as well, which I've got to talk about that. iRobot is basically an unacknowledged remake of a film from about 10 years earlier, which is Virtuosity, the one with Russell Crowe and Denzel Washington. It's got a lot of the same things in it. It's got discredited police officer with one robot arm who happens to be played by an actor of colour. And I'm not saying that the Asimov story is based on Virtuosity at all, but the movies are incredibly parallel, and it's a bit crazy that they are. And that's a bit of an undistinguished one. Then in 2009, he filmed not too far from where I'm sitting right now, when he made Knowing, the Nicolas Cage End of the World movie. There's a big car crash right at the end of Knowing, and that was filmed literally 2 kilometres from where I sit now. And the intersection's changed. They put a roundabout in, probably based on the fact that Rose Byrne died in the movie at that particular intersection. But, yeah, so Proyas is kind of interesting, but not really punching through to the top levels of genre filmmaking. He is doing a movie that's coming out in about a year and a bit called Gods of Egypt, about Egyptian gods and things like that. He's getting a lot of shit for casting white actors as Egyptians, because obviously Egyptian people aren't particularly Celtic, and there are a number of Australian actors he's getting into that. It's filming or maybe in post-production at this stage. But on the other hand, he was born in Egypt, so he may well get a pass for that. Who knows? But Proyas, he's kind of there with the Sperry brothers and a few other people who are trying to start, in some ways, a genre renaissance in Australia. And Proyas, I think, really does need to get some stronger script writing, because one of the problems with Dark City is that it really does flag in the middle. Once you've set up the premise of this morphing city and people's memories being moved around via syringe, which has got to be a really clumsy mechanism for moving information from one place to another. The only thing, of course, is it looks good when you're doing it. So, again, this one is definitely style over substance, which isn't, I mean, I shouldn't be quite so harsh about that sort of thing, because people do go to these kind of movies, particularly in the cinema, for the visuals. And the visuals in this are very striking. At the time, they were even more striking. But this also suffered negatively by being compared to a film that reused some of the sets from this movie, and that is The Matrix. And The Matrix was filmed in exactly the same studio about a year later. And because it was such an enormously popular film, and because it was dynamic and did have some characters apart from Neo who were quite vivid and all those sorts of things, it was kind of, in a sense, compared with Dark City in that it had all of the things that Dark City lacked. And, of course, we'll leave aside the sequels. The sequels were maybe ill-considered. But, yeah, I mean, if you could mix the two together and kind of have the visual sense, in a way, of Dark City mixed with the kinetic nature of The Matrix, maybe you'd have something there. I don't know. But this one, it really does slag in the middle between the end reveal, the setup and the end reveal. They don't quite know what to do with that. I mean, there's the bit where he's captured by the cops and there are lots of chases with the aliens chasing him around, and there's the quite soppy kind of romantic relationship between Rufus Sewell's character and Jennifer Connelly's. And Melissa George turns up as a hooker and does get her kid off, but she was much better and much better served as an actor in a movie I did in a very early Martian Drive-In podcast, being Triangle. That really does show that she's got chops as an actor, whereas this was her first feature role, and it was done because she's attractive and was willing to get her kid off. But again, I rewatched a bit of this morning, and again, I come down to the fact that everybody is playing the acting. Everybody's doing the acting at a very kind of demure tone, and with it all toned down. And you've got to remember that you're seeing this thing, initially at least, in an ideal situation, on a fucking big, enormous screen in a crowd of people. You've got to have some things that pop out at you, and yeah, visuals will carry you a certain distance, but acting and characterization and just having characters that belong on so large a screen is an important aspect of the film watching experience. I mean, maybe the style over substance thing is partly related to the fact that Proyas's early career was involved in doing a lot of music videos. I mean, he did some for Drop Bears, in Excess, Mike Oldfield, Crowded House. I did two different ones for Crowded House and Sting, apart from anything else. So having that kind of, in a music video, you don't get the chance to do much in the way of characterization, I suppose. But you've got to have a striking visual style. And I think Preuss made that mistake in this film. But on the other hand, I like the fact that anybody who's an Australian director got the ability to make a film. It's so hard to get these things up and running, even at the time, about 15 years ago, in Australia, because I think that the funding mechanisms that we have in Australia, and a lot of them are funded by various government instrumentalities, at least until Abbott destroys that aspect of filmmaking, really want to see kind of urban set, either contemporary stories or stories set in a nostalgic past, and this is neither of those things. But having said that, a lot of people like the film, and I'm sure that anything I say isn't going to dissuade them from watching it and enjoying it. The other thing that's really interesting about this is the original cut that came out in February 1998 had a narration at the start by Kiefer Sutherland, which was full of spoilers for the rest of the movie. Now, I'm not sure why they did that, but you can have an enormous list of stupid things the studios have done in post-production in order to try to save a movie they didn't think would be doing well. But on the bright side of it, in 2008, 10 years later, a director's cut came out, which doesn't have that, and stays true to what Preuss intended. And that's the one I watched for this podcast. And yeah, Kiefer Sutherland's character is the one that really itches me, because he's fucking annoying. I mean, he's trying to do Peter Lorre without any of Peter Lorre's vitality and charisma. And I don't think it's particularly a role to which Sutherland is particularly suited. I think getting somebody a little kind of off-kilter and a little less, a little less Brat Pack, I suppose, would have been better. You can name any number of actors, and including a number of Australia actors, that could have done the job just as well or even better. But that wasn't the opportunity. But you do get a few Australian actors in there. Of course, you get Melissa George, you get Colin Friels doing a very small bit, and Colin Friels does lift the energy levels of the movie in a quite interesting way. He's one of the only characters in the movie that shows any kind of life or vitality, and he's great. I mean, I saw Colin Friels many years ago in the 1980s doing a play called Il Magnifico by Robert Archer, which was a resetting of the story of Lorenzo de' Medici, set in contemporary Australia, and the Pope was a Queensland real estate guy and all this kind of thing. And seeing Friels on the stage was dynamic. He was vital. He was jumping around the stage. He was athletic. He was basically riveting to see. And he brings a bit of that to this particular role. And I think of all the characters in the film, in the few minutes that he's on screen, he really does give you something to latch onto emotionally in this movie, whereas all the other characters simply don't. So all credit to Colin Friels there. But there's not too much else to say about Dark City. As I said, the cityscapes were great, and the miniature work that Lewis Morley and his team did at the time for that is admirable. But I think that two things let it down. One, the initial premise is one that's kind of sets the movie maker up for failure. Having that, everybody's a bit vague because their memories have been scrambled around between different people, is something that he maybe should have. It kind of parallels the acting process in a weird way. You can do this two ways. You can go in and cash a check, and these characters are kind of cashing a check for the people they're supposed to be. Or you can go in gung-ho and all guns blazing and bringing in your talents and your A-game and made them vivid. It would have been much more creepy if all of these vivid characters in A City of the Night, all these characters that you like and engage with, end up being just something that came out of a syringe. I think that would have been a much stronger premise than having just, you know, everybody's a bit kind of out of it because their memories have been scrambled. They had made them vivid and alive and vital and engaging. and then find out that all of their lives are a lie, I think that's much, much stronger. But let me know what you think about that, because it's... And, of course, the movie that must have some value there, because I have been thinking about it a lot since I watched it, and mostly thinking about where the wheels had fallen off it, admittedly. But to that extent, the movie does engage enough so that I was kind of positively disposed towards it, and I wanted it to be much, much better than it actually was. And that, you know, maybe it's a kind of parochialism in me. Maybe it's the fact that it's an Australian film and I want it to be the best it can possibly be. Or maybe I just want to see a genre film that's the best it can possibly be. Who knows? But either way, I think that Dark City is a bold attempt at something different in genre films. I think its timing was unfortunate, given the fact it's negatively being compared to The Matrix. But I think that Alex Proyas really did need somebody sitting at his shoulder going, hang on, why don't you try this instead? Which he didn't. Anyway, that's about it for that one. I'm going to take a break. Now, when I get back, there's a little bit of news from Mars. And then after that, we're going to look at a movie that I like a lot better, even though it had a tiny budget. Even though the actors are kind of young and inexperienced. But it's got a vitality and a joie de vivre and a kind of sense of wonder that is what we look for in science fiction films. And that, of course, is 1985's My Science Project.
When the rumba rhythm start to play, dance with me, make me sway. Like a lazy ocean hugs the shore, hold me close, sway me more. Like a flower bending in the breeze, bend with me, sway with ease. When we dance, you have a way with me, stay with me, sway with me.
There's a lot to be said for just a fun, silly science fiction movie now and then. Something that's light and entertainment, not meant to be serious at all. And basically, you know, it makes you feel good for an hour and a half. And for me, My Science Project is one of those films. It was made by a guy called Jonathan Boutel. He wrote and directed it. Didn't do too much else apart from that. And the stars aren't very big, with one exception. The stars are John Stockwell, Danielle von Ziering, and Fisher Stevens, and also, in a fairly small role, but a very important one, Dennis Hopper, playing Bob, the science teacher. The story is fairly simple. In the 1950s, a UFO is found, and President Eisenhower tells the military to get rid of it. So they dump all of the gear into a military base, which then becomes a derelict military base where they just store junked airplanes and things like that. And in 1985, a kid called Michael Harlan, on his first date with a girl called Ellie, finds the engine part of the spaceship when he's looking for something for a science project. The science project, which the science teacher Bob tells him he needs to get an A in to be able to pass and graduate from high school, is something that he's not good at. Michael's a meathead. He's a rev head. He likes cars and fixing up cars, and that's what he likes to do, basically. He's just been dumped by a very shallow girlfriend, and his best friend, Vince, is a comic sidekick played by Fisher Stevens, who was transplanted to Arizona, where the story's set, from New York, and is still very much a New York kind of guy. He wears bowling shirts, he's got slick hair, and he's got a kind of New York attitude about him, which is kind of fun. So the three of them start trying to figure out what this thing does. Basically, it's a big plasma ball with some machinery at either end of it, though we didn't really know what plasma balls were in 1985. And it starts doing weird things, and they hook it up to a battery, and weird things happen. It sucks all the juice out of a boombox. They then take it to Bob to find out what's going on with this thing. And here is what happens.
Oh, ye of little faith.
And what is it, Bob?
What is it? I'll tell you what it is. It's a time-space warp that's created by this gizmo that will warp something into our dimension, or we can travel through time and space.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah!
Let's call People Magazine.
No. Hey, I vote we tell the police about this.
The pigs. No pigs. No. No.
Come on, unhook it, Vince.
No.
What should we do, Bob?
Do? I'll show you what we'll do.
Mr. Roberts!
What's going on?
The dimension barriers, they're breaking away. Oh, it is a gateway.
The connection, then.
No!
No, Mikey, you disconnected, go!
No. You don't know what you're looking at. You don't know what you see. I mean, it's pure time. Pure space. No.
Michael, don't listen. Stop it.
Mikey, stop it. Do something.
I'm at the headwaters of creation. I feel the whole universe in my fingertips.
No, Bob.
All of it.
Bobby.
I feel. Feel it. Infinity. What a rush.
No.
Which goes to show you why you shouldn't let hippie science teachers play with time warp devices. Meanwhile, the team also have to deal with a nerdy guy called Sherman, whose name is obviously a reference to Peabody and Sherman, who's basically trying to mess them up at every stage and get them in trouble wherever he can. Usual kind of teenage. He's not really a villain. He's just a fucked up kind of kid. So the problem is they've got this time warp going, and they decide they've got to get, and it's hooked up to the electricity grid. So they need to disconnect the electricity grid. They rush out to outside town and have to try to cut the power lines to stop the energy getting there and perpetuating the time warp, which is taking over the school. So that's basically the setup. That's some of it as well. And it's a lot of fun. The movie suffered, unfortunately, from a couple of problems, one of which was that it came out contemporary with two enormous, much, much, much larger budgeted science fiction teen comedy kind of films. Well, not science fiction teen comedy, but science fiction comedy films. The first being Ghostbusters, and the second one being Back to the Future. It was kind of slotted right in the middle of those two. And so it didn't obviously get any oxygen. The big guys were sucking it all out of the air. And in fact, that's the reason why in Sweden the movie's known as Time Busters, because they wanted to make it a little bit like Ghostbusters and a little bit like Back to the Future. But I think it's a standalone film. I first saw this on VHS many moons ago. It was brought out, I think, by Roadshow Video, and they bought up tons and tons and tons of the rights to these kind of low and middle budget science fiction and fantasy and horror films and put them out in video shops. This is just slightly before people could purchase VHS tapes, in Australia at least. We'll talk a little bit about that too, because it was an interesting time. Video shops had tons and tons of movies. We hadn't quite gotten the hang of cross-taping yet. And I was a bit lucky because I was living in Glebe around this time, and just a little bit later than this movie came out, where there was a little warehouse outlet which sold ex-rental tapes that video shops no longer wanted. And, you know, this is a nostalgia thing now, because within about 10K, if you're on one video shop that still exists. But, so basically I could go down there and pay. They had a whole bunch of these Roadshow tapes going for $5 and $10 each, which wasn't, you know, it was more money then than it is now, but it still wasn't a considerable amount of money. So I ended up buying up a whole bunch of these things whenever I could afford to, which caused a storage problem because VHS tapes being a lot bigger than DVDs or Blu-rays. But nonetheless, I bought up a lot of them, and my science project was one of them, and I liked it. It's got some good practical effects in it. Now, you've got to remember this is 1985, so you haven't got CGI. You haven't got industrial light and magic working for you in all cases, or even Weta Workshop. But they've got the usual very 1980s-looking special effects, you know, the light glancing down from the sky and the big swirling thing in the sky being the space warp and that kind of stuff. And it... it's all done very, very well. I mean, there's not... It was maybe state-of-the-art at the time. It was really well-made special effects, and they were targeted very well. Of course, with a lower budget, you can't really do special effects wall-to-wall in those days. But they targeted where they put the special effects in pretty well. And there are some great scenes. There's Vince, the comic sidekick there. There's John Stockwell playing the hero. Now, John Stockwell, people might remember, was in the adaptation of Stephen King's Christine and did a few other things. Radioactive Dreams he did as well around the time. I think was it Richard Band who did that? But he was in there. And Daniel von Ziering, who... didn't go on to have a great career, but at the time I thought she was rather cute, you know, blonde, one of those geeky blonde girls who looks a lot better according to everybody when she takes her glasses off. You got Raphael Sabarge, who's now doing episodic TV still. A lot of these actors are still going. He's doing episodic TV in America at the moment. John Stockwell's directed a few films, Blue Crush, I think he did, and amongst others, and writing screenplays. And Fisher Stevens turned up in Grand Budapest Hotel recently, so it's all rather cool. A lot of these people are still working in the industry, apart from obviously the director. But getting back to Dennis Hopper, I mean, this is Dennis Hopper in his hippie crazy mode, and I kind of like it as well. He's really over the top. He does the science teacher thing very well. He's one of those, he plays it like low key at the start, where he's, you know, trying to get these kids through school and get them an interest in science. And he's very sympathetic to the kids, even though some of them aren't particularly gifted in science, as indeed Michael Harlan isn't, the character played by John Stockwell. So there's a more warmth to Dennis Hopper's characterization in this one that's really great. And then he gets sucked up by a time warp. And then he comes back again right at the end of the film. And this is one of the joys of this movie, just seeing Dennis Hopper in full Easy Rider get up like this.
And the future is a groove, man! I made sure of that. It's a funky valley high! Oh,
yeah! I think I'm going to have to get a T-shirt made up saying it's a funky valley high. But, yeah, I kind of like it for that reason. It's one of those movies that's pure entertainment. It's a little bit of fun. I like it a lot better than I like Back to the Future, because I always found Marty McFly to be a little pussy and never really liked Michael J. Fox's persona in that kind of thing. Michael J. Fox always struck me, particularly in these kind of movies, as very mannered. There's not a naturalness or a genuineness about his acting. And the Back to the Future stuff that Zemeckis did really didn't grab me at all. You know, it wasn't my kind. Oh, it's in my genre, of course. It's a genre that I love. But I thought that it's a little bit talking down to the genre in a sense. Yeah, you know, going back and then, you know, having your mother try to pick you up and all that kind of stuff. It's very American that way, with mummy fixations and all that kind of thing. Not my kind of thing. I'd much rather something, a good, honest little B picture like this one, which basically sets up a premise. Time warp in a school, and there's some great scenes in there too, where the guys go up against Neanderthal men, supposedly Neanderthals, they're more like ape men, things like that. And there's a dinosaur in there, which is done quite subtly. I mean, you got to remember this is physical effects rather than CGI, so it was the old school non-feathered dinosaurs. Though I did read recently there is something coming out soon where they have a T-Rex that actually has feathers the way it should and is in bright colours. So that's going to be interesting to see how our knowledge of dinosaurs and things like that is going to evolve the way that they're portrayed in cinema and television. Of course, the recent Doctor Who thing had the usual scaly, naked dinosaurs. So let me know if you see anything that's got feathered dinosaurs in it, because feathered dinosaurs are always much more interesting than the old-fashioned the old-fashioned dinosaurs, which are kind of the equivalent of a Sphinx cataract, really, aren't they? But, I like this movie. I really do like it. It's not great, but it's fun, and it's honest fun, and it doesn't try to be more than it is. And there's no real villains in the piece. I mean, yeah, there's cops trying to do their jobs, and there's Sherman being a dick, but even Sherman has a redemption at the end of the film. So it's a little more like that. The villain in the piece basically is a piece of alien technology, which the guys trigger and cause all sorts of ructions in there. Now, I would love to have seen a sequel to this film too, come to think of it as well. I mean, what happens when the cops go in there and find all these medieval weapons, a knocked-out Neanderthal man, probably some walls ripped out, maybe a dinosaur track or two in there and that kind of thing? It would have left itself open to some really interesting possibilities as far as the sequel's concerned. That would have been much more groovy than anything that came up from the Back to the Future franchise, for instance. And, of course, I want to know what happened to Bob Roberts, the science teacher. And, yes, his name's Bob Roberts, just like the Tim Robbins movie. After he got arrested, and what happened to him while he was travelling through time. He went to Woodstock. He did protests in Haight-Ashbury. He did all sorts of things while he was away, travelling through time. And that opens up the possibility of something very, very groovy, which I would like to see, which is hippie time travellers. I mean, yeah, you got Doctor Who, but Doctor Who's very much orthodox in a sense, but I like the idea of a hippie time traveller just going around and tweaking things to make the world a better place. I think that's a very lovely concept, and it's like anything that starts with H people don't like for some reason. It's like, I'm going to digress here, so indulge me, it's my podcast. But I don't know what people's problem with hipsters is. Yes, they're guys with beards, but they're, you know, and yes, they're mannered in a certain way, and they've got a certain tribal traits about them, but everybody did. I mean, punks had it, hippies had it, greasers had it, the beatniks had it, every kind of countercultural group and every kind of group that young people start. And hipsters only seem to be guys for some reason. I'm not sure what the female equivalent of hipsters is. But they always get knocked. I mean, yuppies did, because yuppies were only about money and about significant and visible signs of wealth. So, you know, that it was okay to knock yuppies. But hipsters, I haven't got a problem with. I mean, a lot of the baristas that I get coffee from are hipsters. I've never met one that was aggressive or nasty to me at all. And they tend to, you know, do their own thing, and they're finding their own path, and they're finding their own identity in life. So I think people should back off on hipsters, really. It's just a kind of trendy thing to knock them. If you're going to knock anything, knock ISIL. I mean, fuck them. But hipsters, basically, not a big problem for me. Yeah, they got big bushy beards, and good luck to them too, because a lot of people in history had big bushy beards and did good things. But yeah, like hippies, hipsters get a bad rush. And maybe you could have something like, you know, a hippie time traveler with a companion who's a hipster, just to really fuck with people's heads. I mean, that would be a lovely concept. I would go to see a movie based on that concept every day of the fucking week. I like the idea of rubbing people's faces in their own prejudices. But having said that, my science project, good, honest science fiction comedy, kind of plays around with things a little bit, doesn't take itself seriously, and it gives you full value for whatever you invest in watching it. So I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, I'm going to do the news from Mars, and then maybe some feedback, and then we're going to wrap this puppy up.
It's a funky Bali High!
Bali High, may call you any night, any day. In your heart, you hear it call you. Come away, come away.
Sports or entertainment or strange in bars. You stand around, you stand some more. On a planet named for a Roman god of war. Nothing ever happens on Mars. No
supersonic airplanes, no sporty cars. The sun comes up, the sun goes down. You can't go to the country, you can't go to town. Boring, 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 boring.
But there is stuff happening on Mars. India has sent a space probe to Mars. And it costs less than it takes, $74 million, in fact, less than it takes to make a movie about going to Mars, which is kind of cool. It's a Mars orbiter mission, and the space probe is called Magallan, which is kind of cool. It's been sending photos back over a few days, and they've been tweeting about it a little bit. There's things, the Indian Space Research Organization's been sending out tweets about it, saying the view's nice up here. And a shot of Mars, I'm getting better at it, no pressure, boom tish. And the name Magallan is Mars craft in Sanskrit, which is kind of cool. So, yeah, they've done pretty well with it. The Mars, it's a centerpiece of India's $74 million Mars orbiter mission. And good luck to them. I mean, yeah, good on India for doing that. They're starting to become a real technological powerhouse in Asia and doing good things. Of course, having 1.3 billion people to as a basis for a technological civilization isn't a bad start, I suppose, but they're doing really great things. It's not going to be all bells and whistles, and it's not going to be necessarily tons and tons of HD images the way the American probes have been, but yeah, it's kind of cool that other people are getting out there and taking photos of other planets and things like that. It can only lead to a better future in space, and if it gets kids involved as well, if kids start taking an interest because of things like this, all the better for us. I mean, I'm living in a country at the moment where my government is deeply technophobic, and that's a big problem. At the climate change conference at the UN, basically everybody walked out when Australia started talking about the bullshit ways that the current Conservative government is ostensibly going to address climate change. So, yeah, good on India for doing that. And all I can do is kind of wait out this regime and see, hopefully, in Australia where we start taking more of an interest in science in particular and climate science in specifics. But great, India, you've done good. And I look forward to more pictures from the space probe that you sent to Mars. So that's about all of the Martian news. Yeah, there is a little bit of others. I think one of the American space probes found something roughly spherical on Mars. My advice is don't touch it. Anything that looks really weird on Mars, we know from many, many years of science fiction movies, you don't fuck around with it. You don't touch it. You don't bring it back in particular, though this one, of course, the American probes at the moment can't bring things back. But basically, don't fuck with things that look weird on other planets. This is the rule that you should follow. You don't know what it is, you don't know where it's been, and you may end up regretting doing so. But anyway, that's about it. And that's it for the podcast as well. I'd like to thank again the Patreon subscribers and, of course, listeners as well. Even if you can't throw money my way when I dance, it's good to know that people are listening, and the podcast stats are very healthy at the moment, but a little bit of feedback wouldn't hurt. So anyway, that's about it. I'll be back in 2 weeks with something else entirely. I've got a little bit of an idea that I'm going to have to work on a bit before it comes to fruition, but it may be slightly different for the podcast, but I am looking forward to doing that. But anyway, take care of yourselves, look after yourselves, and all the best to everybody, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with another one of these.